personal lessons with the rest of the world and their constituents and say, hey, you know, my family and I want to show you an evening into here's how we're going to eat. And look, we got a garden on the White House roof. I didn't know that. I didn't know that till I read that. We have our food is all organic and we support local farmers. Wow. We want fresh local.
Wouldn't that have been something?
Well, what do you think that would do? What do you want to bet? You wouldn't have enough space at Union Square to get people there on Saturday,
That's
right?
That's true, yes.
So we have to now encourage them in a positive way to make the choices that they have made for themselves personally to make them for the rest of the country. If it's good enough for their family, why isn't it good enough for someone else's family? So what do you want to bet that that holistic detoxification has been in the life of at least two of those people?
I wouldn't.
What do you want to bet me?
No.
And I know that
yep,
for a fact.
I'm sure.
All right? That I know. So concepts of detoxification should not be some abstract existential belief. It should be practical. Each day when you start your day, will this create toxicity or detoxify me? And select those things that are nourishing, healthy, delicious, nutritious, the detox. I want detox to be fun, so therefore I made it such way that it's fun. So I'll show you the breakfast, the lunch, the dinner, the salads, the soups, the entrees, the snacks that you can take that are detoxifying, you know, that you actually benefit from, but they actually detoxify you. So you don't have the bloating and swelling. You don't have the high blood pressure. All that is directly related to how toxic you are. They are one and the same. So this idea that a person can eat a garbage diet and be healthy is just nonsense. You just can't. It's just that in that moment, you don't know when you're going to pay the price. So this is a tool to help, and that's all it is. It's just a tool. It's just one tool. There are many others. But it's the one that I have found has been most useful to starting people on their journey to reclaim their health. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about people who are even in the field. You have no idea how many famous doctors and nutritionists and people who have a bestseller come to me because, oh, gee, Gary, and I kind of got off the beaten track, and now I have this and I have that, and, you know, I can't, it's not changing, and I don't know what to do. Okay, so I help them, and I get over it. So they can go back to helping people. Isn't that the object of the exercise? And you know what, Michael G., I have found most people are decent and ethical enough and moral enough that if they've been personally helped, they try to pass it on. That's what we want. So
indeed.
Call now, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. And for, it's $100, Michael G.?
That's right. It's $100, and we're down to the last 2 minutes of the
okay,
broadcast today.
2 minutes. So call now, and you will get Detoxification, the documentary. And as you heard Luann Panessi, look, she's a hardcore healthcare worker. Mm-hmm. She's worked in the trenches in oncology nursing, cancer nursing,
yes.
Was a nurse administrator of a whole hospital, Long Island Jewish Hospital. She was in the trenches for 35 years she's been at this. Yet nothing could help her with what she had. Until I put her on a detox. This very detox, what I put her on.
Detoxification.
So that's where she started to reverse her hepatitis and her herpes and her cytomegalovirus and Epstein-Barr virus and adult acne. And then now, you want to know how many people she's helped with this? I've seen them. Thousands of people she's helped.
Oh,
Luann,
man.
We're coming up to the end here. Are you still there?
I sure am.
Luann, if anybody would like to speak to you, give us your number, please.
Surely. It's 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. I'm happy to answer your question.
Thank you very much. And again, no better way to see what works than to call someone that it's worked on. And she has no shortage of people who can tell you how their lives have been turned around. And that's what my goal is, to help people live a longer and healthier and happier life. That's it. Nothing more than that. It's that simple. There's no alternative motive. It's not about fame. It's not about fortune. It's not about ego. It's not about any of that. That is all irrelevant. It is about helping people and creating the tools that allow them to live a more meaningful life. Because when you're healthy, Think how much better you feel. So call now, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, and ask for Detoxification and Natural Approach.
Thank you, Gary.
Now, Michael G., how many people are on the phone right now?
Right now, we have 7 people on the line, and we'll get a few more as we say goodbye and welcome the next program into the studio.
Great. Well, have a nice day, everyone. I look forward to being back tomorrow at noon and sharing additional insights.
Thank you so much, Gary. Thank you very, very much.
This is how we do.
Coming up Wednesday, November 21st, the show heard on WBAI in conjunction with WBAI brings you another after-work celebration of funk, soul, R&B, disco, and hip-hop. If you missed it back in September, here's your chance to join in and party to music from the 70s to today. And celebrate the birthdays of hip-hop legends Kool DJ Red Alert and JDL of the Cold Crush Brothers. It's free to get in, but a portion of the proceeds from the bar will go to support WBAI. Plus, there's no work the next day. I'll be on the set as your DJ, Miss ID, a.k.a. Ife, as well as DJ Max Jerome. That's Wednesday, November 21st, 6 to 10 p.m. at Le Croissant Rouge, 158 Bleecker Street in Manhattan. For more information, please call 212-209-2941. 99.5 WBAI.
I'm Harry Allen. This is Nonfiction. And Nonfiction is the magazine of the arts, ideas, and fact, airing every Friday, 2 to 3 p.m., over WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Tune in for a wide range of compelling topics, informed guests, and penetrating interviews. That's Fridays, 2 to 3 p.m., Nonfiction, over WBAI New York and WBAI.org.
This is WBAI. We are a listener-sponsored commercial-free radio station, which means that we do not accept any corporate or commercial underwriting. We rely on your support in order to keep the lights on and the microphones live here at the radio station. We come to you a few times a year, and we ask you to honor your part in that commitment, which is something that you have done consistently and with great generosity for more than half a century now. And others before you have paved that path for us, so that you and I have this jewel, this diadem in the middle of the FM dial. We have this now because of the tremendous contributions that were made by so many others who have preceded us to this space. And we are now custodians of this diadem, and it is our responsibility to keep it alive and to make it grow and to thrive and to achieve even more of its innate potential, so that we can bequeath it in time to others who are yet to come. It is all part of this continuum, you see. So we are now the custodians. The baton has been handed to us, and we're running with it at full tilt. Tilt. And thanks to your support, we are here today in the middle of the FM dial in the number one media market in the world. We are WBAI. We are Pacifica. Thank you so much for your support. You know, tonight will be the second of the three scheduled presidential debates between President Barack Obama and his Republican challenger Mitt Romney. And the audience for tonight's town hall style presidential debate is supposed to consist of undecided voters who were selected by the Gallup organization. Now, how anyone could conceivably be undecided in this presidential election at this stage of the game is entirely beyond me. I have to tell you, I do not know what more there is to be heard on either side in order for you to determine whether you will vote for either of these two presidential candidates. The Democrat is, of course, the incumbent, President Barack Obama, his Republican challenger, Mitt Romney. There are third-party candidates as well. Jill Stein from the Green Party comes to mind. The third-party candidates are not part of the town hall. Not part of the presidential debates. We have in previous segments of this on this program discussed the Commission on Presidential Debates. We've had the executive director of the organization that is the number one critic of the Commission on Presidential Debates here on Talkback to tell us what's wrong with the system that we have now. We've had that conversation before, so you know as well as anyone else, you are as informed as anyone else, what's wrong with the system that we have now, where the shortfall lies, where the deficiencies are, and so forth. But how anyone, as I said, could be undecided at this stage of the game is beyond me. But somehow the Gallup organization is supposed to have found and rounded up these individuals who are undecided voters. And these town hall participants are also supposed to be the ones coming up with the questions. And I can only hope, especially since the debate is taking place at Hofstra, which is well within our listening area. Hofstra is located out on Long Island. We are primary signal area is New York, New Jersey, the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut metropolitan, tri-state metropolitan area. That's New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. On a clear day, you can even hear us in parts of Pennsylvania. And of course, we are reaching everywhere around the world via the internet at WBAI.org, where these programs are also archived for a period of 90 days from the date of broadcast. So, in our primary signal area, Hofstra is well within that area. We are going to be broadcasting the debate this evening here on WBAI as well. And I have to remember to tell you the story of the last debate, because I listened to most of the last debate on the radio because I was commuting from Brooklyn to where I live in Queens, having moderated a public forum at Medgar Evers College on the evening of October 3rd, which was the evening of the first debate. So much of the brouhaha that erupted over President Obama's performance in that debate was completely lost to me, because having heard the debate on the radio and therefore not having seen the demeanor, deportment, or any of the body language of the participants, many of the references that people were making in their analysis of the debate were completely lost on me because I had not seen them. I only saw those references, the meaning. I only was able to understand the meaning of those references afterward when I looked at a rebroadcast of the debate. So that's a whole separate story in the way in which we access information and how that how the medium helps to shape not only the way we understand and receive the message, but also how it helps to shape the way in which we respond to the message. So that those people who heard the debate on the radio quite likely had an entirely different impression as did I, about how the whole thing unfolded, different from the experience of those people who were visually engaged by looking at the debate on television. And we can on a future occasion discuss whether this is a plus or minus, which medium better serves the public interest in this particular, in this way, whether perhaps on television we become so distracted by things that are irrelevant or immaterial or of little consequence that we might sometimes lose sight of the substance of things because we become so hung up on the style of their presentation. Anyway, getting back to the matter at hand and this evening's debate, the people in the participants in this evening's town hall are supposed to be the ones who are coming up with the questions. And I can only hope, especially since Hofstra is well within our primary signal area, that some of those participants are listening right now, because it is probably the only way that some of the questions that I am thinking about are going to be asked. And among them, question number one. Dear participant or candidate, Mr. Candidate, why are there more people under correctional supervision in the United States today, more than 6 million in all, than were imprisoned in the Gulag Archipelago at its height under Stalin? And what are you going to do about it? Now, that's a question I would like to hear somebody ask of Mr. Obama and of Mr. Romney this evening. Question number two, Mr. Candidate. What do you think accounts for the fact that there are now more black men in prison, on probation, or on parole than were enslaved in this country in 1850? I would love to hear those candidates, the two candidates, provide us with an analysis of what they believe accounts for that fact. And question number three. Mr. Candidate, what is your position on the privatization of prisons for corporate profit? Specifically, what do you think of a recent proposal by the Corrections Corporation of America to buy and manage public prisons in 48 states in exchange for a commitment from those states to maintain a minimum 90% occupancy rate in those prisons for at least 20 years. Now, that is a question that I think bears repeating, because the underlying facts of this question are stunning. Specifically, Mr. Candidate, what do you think of a recent proposal by the Corrections Corporation of America to buy and manage public prisons in 48 states in exchange for a commitment from those states to maintain a minimum 90% occupancy rate in those prisons for at least 20 years? I would love to hear those questions being asked. Now, personally, I think it is very unlikely that any of those questions are going to be asked of the presidential candidates tonight or any other night. And that's just one more reason why WBAI is so important, because it is often the case that we're the only media organization standing between you and what my colleague Howard Jordan calls the total and complete invisibilization of entire segments of our society. Those 6 million people who are under some form of correctional supervision in this country today, together with their parents, their spouses, their children, their extended families and friends, they constitute a population that is larger than that of many countries in the world. And yet, few are willing to plead their cause in public. Few, that is to say, who are holding elective office or who seek elective office or who are in a position of public advocacy or public trust, few are willing to plead the cause of those 6 million people and their extended families. Those 6 million people who are under some form of correctional supervision in this country today. Many, and because so few people are willing to plead that cause in the public discourse, but for the efforts of our own WBAI and a few others, these are segments or constituencies in our society that have been virtually abandoned to become the fodder for corporate profit in an out-of-control prison industrial complex. Let me share with you an excerpt from a piece written by John Whitehead, the attorney and author. This is a piece published earlier this year at the Huffington Post, a piece titled Jailing Americans for Profit, The Rise of the Prison Industrial Complex. And before I do that, though, just let me say this. It is 20 minutes after the hour. This is WBAI New York, and it is the Tuesday edition of the program Talk Back. This afternoon, we are continuing our fall membership and fundraising drive, and the number to call with your pledge of support to WBAI is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. We've got a full complement of volunteers who are standing by right now to take your call. You can make your pledge of support. You can honor your pledge to WBAI in any of a number of ways. You can use your Visa, American Express, or MasterCard. You can honor your pledge with a personal check or money order. You can use the electronic funds transfer system or the installment plan. The number is 212-209-2950. The important thing is to make a pledge of support to WBAI at a level that is comfortable and convenient for you. 212-209-2950. Now, John Whitehead, the attorney and author, in a piece titled Jailing Americans for Profit, The Rise of the Prison Industrial Complex, writes, consider this. That despite the fact that violent crime in America has been on the decline, the nation's incarceration rate has tripled since 1980. By the way, let me give a shout out to Brother Africa, who was also there last evening. And it was the first time that we'd met, and I was so happy to meet with him. He was one of those asking questions at the end of the presentation last evening, and it was really such a wonderful pleasure to meet with Brother Africa in person. As soon as he began to ask his question, I said, I know, this has got to be Brother Africa. So it was really great. So thank you very much, Brother Africa, for making the trip out here from New Jersey, as did so many others. We had participants there last evening from upstate New York, from Kingston, and from points farther north and east of the city. It was very, very well attended. In fact, one of our supporters there last evening told me that she had gone down to, I think, Richmond, Virginia, to bring her brother up here to New York for this event last evening. So that just gives you a sense of the breadth of the support and the presence that we enjoyed last evening. Anyway, getting back to John Whitehead's piece on Jailing Americans for Profit, The Rise of the Prison Industrial Complex. He points out that approximately 13 million people are introduced to American jails in any given year. And incredibly, more than 6 million people are under correctional supervision in America, meaning that 1 in 50 Americans is working his or her way through the prison system, either as an inmate or while on parole or probation. At the moment, 1 of every 100 Americans is serving time behind bars. Think about that for a moment. That 1 of every 100 Americans is serving time behind bars even as we speak. Little wonder then, Whitehead writes, that public prisons are overcrowded. Yet, while providing security, housing, food, medical care, and so on for 6 million Americans is a hardship for cash-strapped states, to profit-hungry corporations, such as the Corrections Corporation of America, the CCA, and GEO Group, the leaders in the partnership corrections industry, this is a $70 billion gold mine. And thus, with an eye toward increasing its bottom line, CCA, that's the Corrections Corporation of America, has floated a proposal to prison officials in 48 states offering to buy and manage public prisons at a substantial cost savings to the states. In exchange, and here's the kicker, in exchange, the prisons would have to contain at least 1,000 beds. And the states would have to agree to maintain a 90% occupancy rate in the privately run prison for at least 20 years. As Whitehead writes, the problem with this scenario is this, that while states may be tempted by the quick infusion of cash, they would be obligated to maintain these occupancy rates, and the subtle pressure would be applied to make sentencing laws more severe with a clear intent to drive up the prison population. And unfortunately, that's exactly what has happened. Among the laws aimed at increasing the prison population and growing the profit margins of state of special interest corporations like CCA are those three strike laws mandating sentences of 25 years to life for multiple felony convictions, and the so-called truth in sentencing legislation mandating that those who are sentenced to prison must serve most or all of their time. Whitehead writes, in making its pitch to potential investors, the Corrections Corporation of America points out that private prisons comprise a unique recession-resistant investment opportunity, with more than 90% of the market up for grabs, and with little competition, high recidivism among prisoners, and the potential for accelerated growth in inmate populations following the recession. In other words, caging humans for profit is a sure bet because the American population is growing dramatically and the prison population will grow proportionally as well, and more prisoners, of course, would equal more profits. In this way, as Whitehead writes, under the pretext of being tough on crime, state governments can fatten their coffers and fill the jail cells of their corporate benefactors. However, while a flourishing privatized prison system is a financial windfall for corporate investors, it bodes ill for any measures aimed at reforming prisoners and reducing crime. CCA understands this, as it has warned investors efforts to decriminalize certain activities, such as drug use, and here principally they're talking about possession of marijuana, could cut into their profits. So too would measures aimed at reducing the prison system's disproportionately racist impact on minorities, given that the incarceration rate for blacks is 7 times that of whites. Immigrants are also heavily impacted, with roughly 2.5 million people having been through the immigration detention system since 2003. As private prisons begin to dominate, the many troubling characteristics of our so-called criminal justice system, namely racism, economic inequality, inadequate access to legal representation, and lack of process, will only become more acute. Doubtless, a system already riddled by corruption will inevitably become even more corrupt as well. For example, and Whitehead recalls the Kids for Cash scandal that rocked Luzerne County in Pennsylvania back in 2009. Some of you may recall that event, that scandal. For 10 years, the Mid-Atlantic Youth Service Corporation, which specializes in private prisons for juvenile offenders, had paid two judges to jail youths and send them to private prison facilities. The judges, who made over $2.6 million in the scam, had more than 5,000 kids come through their courtrooms and sent many of them to prison for petty crimes such as stealing DVDs from Walmart and trespassing in vacant buildings. When the scheme finally came to light, one judge was sentenced to 17 and a half years in prison and the other received 28 years. But of course, that did not happen before. It was all after thousands of young lives had already been ruined. Now, John Whitehead writes, in this way, minor criminals, from drug users to petty thieves, are being handed over to corporations for lengthy prison sentences, which do nothing to protect society or prevent recidivism. This is the culmination of an inverted justice system that has come to characterize the United States, a justice system based on increasing the power and wealth of the corporate state. That from John W. Whitehead, attorney and author, in a piece published in the Huffington Post, titled jailing Americans for profit, the rise of the prison industrial complex. Now, over the course of this afternoon's program, I'm going to be sharing with you excerpts from what longtime listeners already know to be arguably the foremost prison rights advocate at the moment in this country, and that is Professor Michelle Alexander, who is also author of the book The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. I'm going to share with you excerpts from a lecture she delivered at the Abyssinian Baptist Church earlier this year. And this lecture is titled The New Jim Crow. I also have copies of her book that I'd like to make available to you. And if you have not yet done your holiday shopping or whatever, this would be a great opportunity for you to get a copy of Professor Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. This, of course, the book, of course, is a New York Times bestseller. It is out now in paperback, which means that we can now make it available to you at a lot less than we have been able to offer it as a gift in previous drives. So the book is available this afternoon as a thank you gift to you. Thank you so much with your pledge at the $60 level. That's a $60 pledge to WBAI gets you The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Also at the $60 pledge level, you can get a copy of the DVD of Professor Michelle Alexander's talk earlier this year on and about The New Jim Crow. And get this, though. Get this. I'll send you, we'll send you both the book and the DVD with your pledge at the $100 level. Think about that for a second. You get both the book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, and you get the lecture on DVD by Professor Michelle Alexander. You get them both with a pledge at the $100 level. So your $60 pledge gets you either of the two. Your $100 pledge gets you both. And the number to call is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Once in a while, a book comes along that changes the way we see the world and helps us to fuel a nationwide social movement. The New Jim Crow is such a book. Now, some of you would recall that the very first radio program that Professor Michelle Alexander did when her book first was published was right here on Talkback. She sat in this very chair that I'm looking at right now, across from me here. She came here directly, in fact, from the airport with her rollerboard in tow. Arriving here, she was going to be here for on that day for a book signing, book party in Manhattan, and this was her very first stop. It was the very first radio interview she did about the book. It was right here. And so we have a special relationship with Professor Michelle Alexander. The book has been praised by Harvard Law Professor Lani Guinier as brave and bold. It is a book that directly challenges the notion that the election of Barack Obama signals a new era of color blindness. With dazzling candor, the legal scholar Michelle Alexander argues that we have not ended racial caste in America. We have simply redesigned it. By targeting black men through the war on drugs and decimating communities of color, the U.S. criminal justice system functions as a contemporary system of racial control, relegating millions to a permanent second-class status, even if it formally adheres to the principle of colorblindness. In the words of Benjamin Todd Jealous, president of the and CEO of the NAACP, this book is a call to action. Now, the book has been called stunning by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Levering Lewis and invaluable by the Daily Kos, explosive by Kirkus, and profound necessary by the Miami Herald. What you'll be getting here is a revised and updated paperback edition of The New Jim Crow with a new foreword, by the way, by Professor Cornel West. So if you like me, like I have the original hardcover edition of the book, that is my personal autographed copy. However, I have since had to commit to getting the paperback edition because it is revised and updated. It is the facts and the figures have been updated in this book, and besides, the paperback edition has a new foreword by Professor Cornel West. For those who don't know, Michelle Alexander is an associate professor of law at Ohio State University, and where she holds a joint appointment at the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, formerly the director of the ACLU's Racial Justice Project in Northern California. She served as a law clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Harry A. Blackmun. And Professor Cornel West, who writes, is the author of the new foreword to this edition of the book, is, as you know, the class of 1943 university professor at Princeton University. So we will send you the book with your pledge at the $60 level, or the DVD of Professor Alexander's lecture delivered earlier this year at Abyssinian Baptist Church. You get that one as well. You get that one at the $60 pledge level. Or you can get both the book and the DVD with a pledge of $100 to WBAI. Remember, it's a tax-deductible contribution to this listener-sponsored commercial-free radio station. So I'm asking you now to join those who are on the line at 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950 with your pledge of support to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And streaming live on the web at WBAI.org. We're going to go now, we're going to bring you now an excerpt from Professor Michelle Alexander's talk at the Abyssinian Baptist Church discussing her book and her crusade. It's called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Please continue to keep these calls coming while the presentation is in progress, because the amount of time that we have to spend exhorting you, issuing these exhortations is inversely proportional to the amount of time available for us to bring you the actual content of the lecture. We want to bring you as much as we can of the talk. So please keep the calls coming at 212-209-2950, and we thank you very much for your support. Here now, Professor Michelle Alexander discussing The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness.
Where to begin? A wise woman once told me that, quote, in life there are acts of great faith and acts of great foolishness, and sometimes it's difficult to tell the difference between the two. And when I began writing this book, I was told by many that it was an act of great foolishness. Yet I clung to the belief that it was an act of faith. I felt I was taking a great leap of faith, that if people of faith and conscience had access to the history, the data, all of the sources and information that I could provide in this book, that they too could have the same kind of awakening I finally did, that they too would be able to begin to see the connections between mass incarceration and earlier systems of racial and social control in our country, and that people of faith and conscience would, if given the tools and the information, see the necessity for bold and courageous action, for genuine movement building to end mass incarceration. But as I was writing the book, many people, including some of my mentors and colleagues, told me that writing this book was an act of great foolishness. I was told that I was ruining my career, and that if I hoped to be taken seriously as a law professor or as an academic, I should stick to writing traditional law review articles and not cast myself as some kind of radical. And I must admit that, you know, that for a while I began to believe that perhaps I was engaged in an act of foolishness, and writing the book was so much more difficult than I had imagined, and so my confidence and my hope and faith began to falter. And I started telling my husband that I was going to give up writing the book. Over and over, I would tell him, "No, really, seriously, honey, this time I'm giving up. I'm done for real." And then by no small coincidence, every time I said I was done, I was really quitting it, I was finished with this project, a letter would show up in the mail from a prisoner or a family member who had a loved one who had just been released from prison, begging me to finish the book. While I was writing my book, when it was still a work in progress, I had done a number of media interviews about the work, and I started receiving letters in the mail from people behind bars. And by some small irony, they must have known that I was thinking of giving up the book. One letter began, and I quote, "You're probably thinking about quitting, as I'm sure many people are telling you not to write this book, but do it anyway. Do it for those of us who no longer have a voice." I now see that I would have been a fool not to finish. A movement to end. Yeah, a movement to end mass incarceration is, in fact, emerging in the United States. And while my book may not have catalyzed this movement, it is becoming an important tool, one that would not have existed if I had not listened to spirit whispering in my ear. And so seeing all of you here tonight fills me with joy. I see now that my prayers and my hopes have truly been answered, and that the seeds that I hope to plant right along next to the many other seeds of hope and justice that have been planted by advocates and scholars and family members who are struggling in this era of mass incarceration are beginning to be watered. And soon, I hope and I pray, this movement will come to full bloom, and we will see an end to mass incarceration in America. Martin. Martin Luther King Jr. once said there is, quote, "nothing more tragic than to sleep through a revolution." And he was talking at that time about a profound moral revolution that was underway, a struggle for the recognition of the dignity and value of all humankind, a struggle to put an end to the old Jim Crow. And shortly before he died, he told an audience the story of Rip Van Winkle, who fell asleep for 20 years. When he began his extended nap, there was a sign posted on the wall of a nearby inn with a picture of King George III emblazoned on it. But when Rip Van Winkle woke up two decades later, the inn had a sign of George Washington on it. And Dr. King told the audience that the most striking fact about the story of Rip Van Winkle is not that he slept for 20 years, but rather that he had slept through a revolution. He said, quote, "There are all too many people who, in some great period of social change, failed to achieve the new mental outlooks that the new situation demands." I think his words are as relevant today as they were back then. Many of us, myself included, have slept through a revolution, actually a counter-revolution, that has blown back much of the progress that Dr. King and so many other freedom fighters gave their lives for. This revolution, this counter-revolution, has occurred with barely a whimper of protest. And yet it has successfully relegated millions of poor people, overwhelmingly people of color, to a permanent second-class status, stripping them of the very rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. While many of us have been asleep, a vast new system of racial and social control has emerged that would certainly have Dr. King turning in his grave. One day we may look back and wonder how we could have possibly slept for so long. But I thank God that we are finally waking up. Well, I've been asked tonight to share the thesis of my book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, and to a large extent, the title of the book speaks for itself. I argue that today, in the so-called era of colorblindness, and yes, even in the age of Obama, something akin to a caste system is alive and well in America. The mass incarceration of poor people of color is tantamount to a caste-like system, a system that relegates people to a permanent second-class status nearly as effectively as systems of racial and social control we supposedly left behind. It is, in my view, the moral equivalent of Jim Crow. Now, I acknowledge in the introduction to my book that there was a time when I rejected this kind of talk out of hand. There was a time when I resisted strenuously comparisons between mass incarceration and slavery or mass incarceration and Jim Crow, believing that people who made those kinds of claims and comparisons were engaging in exaggerations, distortions, and hyperbole. In fact, I thought people who made those kinds of claims were actually doing more harm than good to efforts to reform our criminal justice system and achieve greater racial equality in the United States. In fact, the first time I encountered the idea that our criminal justice system might be functioning like a caste system, I was rushing to catch the bus in Oakland, California, and this bright orange poster stapled to a telephone pole caught my eye. And on it, it said in large bold print, "The drug war is the new Jim Crow." And I remember stopping for a minute and scanning the text of the flyer, and I saw that a small community group was holding a meeting at a local church a few blocks away, and they were organizing to protest racial profiling, three strikes law in California, police brutality, the expansion of California's prison system, the drug war. And I remember thinking to myself, yeah, you know, criminal justice system is racist in a lot of ways, but it doesn't help to make such absurd comparisons to Jim Crow. Now, people just think you're crazy. And then I crossed the street, hopped on the bus, headed to my new job as director of the Racial Justice Project for the ACLU in California. Well, when I began my job at the ACLU, I thought I knew a lot about racial bias in our societal institutions. I had been working as a civil rights lawyer for a number of years, representing victims of racial bias, gender bias in employment. We had been suing Fortune 500 companies for gender and race discrimination, companies like Home Depot and public supermarkets in the South, suing them for race and gender discrimination. So I understood well how stereotyping and conscious and unconscious bias can permeate all levels of an organization with truly disastrous consequences. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to take all of the tools that I had developed as a civil rights lawyer fighting employment discrimination, I'm just going to apply those tools, those litigation tools, to criminal justice reform and join with others to root out racial bias wherever and whenever it might rear its ugly head in the criminal justice system. But by the time I left the ACLU, I had come to realize that I had been dead wrong about the criminal justice system. It's not just another institution in our society infected with racial bias, but a different beast entirely. The activists who posted that sign on the telephone pole, they weren't crazy, nor were the smattering of lawyers and activists around the country that were beginning to connect the dots between mass incarceration and earlier forms of racial and social control. It was only after years of representing victims of racial profiling and police brutality and investigating patterns of drug law enforcement in poor communities of color and attempting to assist people released from prison re-enter into a society that had never shown much use for them in the first place, that I finally had a series of experiences that began what I now call my awakening. I began to awaken to a racial reality that is so obvious to me now that what seems odd in retrospect is that I had managed to be blind to it for so long. As I describe in the introduction to my book, what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than the language we use to justify it. In the era of color blindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways in which it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, exclusion from jury service, suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America, we have merely redesigned it. Now, if you're like I was more than a decade ago, and tempted to believe that these kinds of comparisons and analogies are exaggerations or distortions, consider this. There are more African American adults under correctional control today, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. As of 2004, more black men have been stripped of the right to vote, disenfranchised, than in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, prohibiting laws that explicitly deny the right to vote on the basis of race. Now, of course, during the Jim Crow era, black folks were kept from the polls by poll taxes and literacy tests. Well, today, felon disenfranchisement laws accomplish what poll taxes and literacy tests ultimately could not. A black child born today has less of a chance of being raised by both parents than a black child born during slavery. 80% of all African American children can now expect to spend at least a significant part of their childhood years living apart from their fathers. This is due in large part to the mass incarceration of black men. And contrary to the image frequently presented in the media of black men being a bunch of deadbeat dads who don't care about their children, the research shows that black men actually do a better job of maintaining contact with their children following a separation due to imprisonment or divorce or any other factor than men of any other racial or ethnic group. But no other racial or ethnic group faces such an extraordinary challenge in playing the role of a traditional father in our society today. And that's not to say black men couldn't do better, but white men could do better as fathers. Latinos, Asian men could do better as fathers. Black men do a better job at trying than men of any other race. But trying is difficult when you are locked behind bars. When you're jobless or barred by law from residing in the same home as your children and your spouse. Now, this phenomenon of black men kept from their families and their children, their loved ones, doesn't affect some small segment of the black community as we know. To the contrary, in major urban areas, more than half of working age African American men have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. In fact, in the Chicago area, if you take into account prisoners, if you actually count them as people, you know, prisoners are typically excluded from unemployment statistics, poverty statistics, thus masking the severity of racial inequality in the United States. But if you count prisoners as people, in the Chicago area, nearly 80% of working age African American men have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. It was recently reported in a book just published by Ernest Drucker called A Plague of Prisons that in Washington, D.C., that figure has now surpassed 90%. These men are part of a growing undercaste, not class, caste, a group of people defined largely by race, relegated to a permanent second-class status by law. Now, I'm fairly certain that there's at least one person out there who's thinking, what is she talking about? Our criminal justice system isn't a system of racial control, it's a system of crime control. And if black folks would just stop running around committing so many crimes, they wouldn't have to worry about being locked up and then stripped of their basic civil and human rights. But therein lies the greatest myth about mass incarceration, namely that it's been driven by crime and crime rates. It's not true. It's not true. Over the last 30 years, our prison population has exploded, has quintupled. We've gone from a rate of incarceration, we've gone from about 300,000 people behind bars in the mid-1970s to over 2 million today. We now, as a nation, have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing the rates of highly repressive regimes like Russia or China and Iran. But again, this explosion in imprisonment is not due to crime rates. Over the past few decades, crime rates have fluctuated, have gone up, have gone down. Today, as bad as crime rates are in many parts of the country, crime rates are actually at historical lows. But incarceration rates have soared.
Two one two two zero nine two nine five zero. That's 212-209-2950. Why are we pausing here? Well, you know why. We're pausing here to give you the opportunity, first of all, to take a deep breath and also to head over to your telephone. Well, you don't have to head over these days to your telephone. You'll probably be making that call from your cell phone, or maybe you'll be doing this on your iPad or on your touch or on whatever. Whatever tablet you might be using, or however you do this, perhaps you're at work and you're going to be calling us. You're going to be making this contribution online at wbai.org. However you do this, we ask you to do so now. We're pausing to give you the opportunity to make that pledge of support. This lecture, this talk delivered by Professor Michelle Alexander, discussing the new Jim Crow, mass incarceration in the age of colorblindness. This talk is available on DVD as a thank you gift with your pledge at the $60 level. We also have the book, the revised and updated edition of the book, the New York Times bestseller by Professor Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. The book is also available as a standalone item with your pledge at the $60 level. Or you can get both the book and the DVD with a pledge of $100 to WBAI. We are WBAI, listener-sponsored commercial-free radio, and we ask you this afternoon to make that tax-deductible contribution. And let me also say this, I'll be away for a week beginning tomorrow. I'll be off for 1 week beginning tomorrow, so you're not going to, so if you're thinking that, well, you know, I'll catch you next Monday, or I'll catch him on Tuesday, or maybe on Thursday, or when, no, that's not going to happen. I'll be off for about a week beginning tomorrow. So after today, the next time that you and I are going to be doing this is probably going to be on the 25th or the 29th. I am yet to, we are yet to figure out which day it's going to be. I am taking that time off to take care of some of some other matters, and all is well. You know, it's just a time that is due to me. I'm just taking the time off at this time of the year, because it happens to be my favorite time of the year. So the number is 212-209-2950. I'm asking you now to make that call, and please don't procrastinate, because the next time that I'm going to be asking you directly to do this is not going to be before the 25th, and possibly on the 29th. The number is 212-209-2950. You get your very own copy, a personal copy of the new revised and updated edition of Michelle Alexander's New York Times best-selling book, The New Jim Crow: Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. The book, $60. We send it to you. You get the lecture, the talk, that's $60 on we send it to you on DVD, or you get both the book and the DVD with a pledge of $100 to WBAI. We're giving you some dialing music right now. Compliments of Mr. Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer and director of Incidental Music. Please keep these calls coming. We can take another 9 of your calls. We have a full complement of volunteers who are standing by right now to take your call. 212-209-2950. You can use your Visa, American Express, or MasterCard. You can honor your pledge with a personal check or money order. Use the electronic funds transfer system or the installment plan. 212-209-2950. This is WBAI New York, where it is now 4 o'clock. Mr. Michael G. Haskins, who is it? This is really great stuff. I have no idea. How does he do this? This is beautiful music. Who is it?
Oh, wow. This particular tune is Vakasha, The March, African Drums and Voices.
Mm.
And it's just some incidental and complimentary,
yes,
music,
definitely,
for the listeners of WBAI. It is unique, this radio station. I mean, how many, just point to for me, please, how many radio stations play this kind of music regularly? Please point to me and tell me that. But we do here at WBAI. The musical variety is so diverse, incredibly diverse. You'll hear things from the Grateful Dead to African voices and everything in between, far flung. 212-209-2950. We're playing excerpts from the DVD by Michelle Alexander. It's her talk that was given at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. The book is available, The New Jim Crow. Her book is available, The New Jim Crow, is available for a $60 contribution. The DVD is available also for $60. The book DVD contribution of $100 is really a great bargain. The book DVD for $100. 212-209-2950. The New Jim Crow: Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness by Michelle Alexander. Thank you so much for those calls that are coming in right now. We can accommodate a few more of you. Remember, folks, we can pledge, that is to say, you can pledge using Visa, MasterCard, or American Express. And I do believe, talking to the folks in in the back there. They said that Discover, you can do so on this with your Discover card as well. So there are a number of ways that you can pledge electronically, the electronic funds transfer. You can do that as well. But we do need to hear from you now at 212-209-2950. I'm just excited about all of the things that we're doing on WBAI, all of the new information that is coming out, and certainly Michelle Alexander's book. It's been out for a couple of years now, but we are bringing this. It needs to be out. We need to be talking about this every day. And the way that you couch this and you outline this discussion, the discussion around the new Jim Crow today, Hugh, was absolutely perfect. That is
Thank
the
you.
Question that you that the candidates should be asked. They won't be, unfortunately, but we do it here. That is what we do here at WBAI. So let us hear from you now. There are some phone calls open. We need to hear these phones constantly ringing. And when the phones are constantly ringing, we know that we're reaching out to all of you that are listening right now in New Jersey, in New York, in upstate New York, in Connecticut, in parts of Pennsylvania, and those of you listening on the web at WBAI.org. Great. That's what we need.
Indeed.
We need the sustained ringing of those phones throughout this afternoon. Talk back with Hugh Hamilton. I don't know what I'm going to do when he goes away because, you know, this is my raison d'etre. Coming in here to WBAI. I mean, I enjoy everything about being here and all of the programs, but this program is very special to my heart. I am so intellectually stimulated, and I know you are as well. That is why you're pledging right now. I'm going to stop now, and we're going to go back to another excerpt from Michelle Alexander's talk at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. But please continue to call. This is a good showing, and you are acting admirably this afternoon for Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton on WBAI. Thank you so much.
Indeed. Thank you very much indeed. 212-209-2950. And Mr. Haskins, if it is at all possible, when we return in the next break, I would have loved to have some of that that music that you just shared with us. I would have loved to have some of that as an uninterrupted bit of dialing interlude, so to speak, and I'm hoping that perhaps we can do some of that when we return at the next break. But we're operating here on the honor system, so we're going to return to more of Professor Michelle Alexander discussing the new Jim Crow, mass incarceration in the age of colorblindness. You know, years ago, when I started in radio, this was many decades ago. Terrence O. Holder, Terry Holder, who was my general manager at the time, introduced me to what he used to refer to as the theory of shifting audiences. The idea that the fact that you have presented something before does not mean that everybody has heard it who needs to hear it. And you need to revisit particularly matters of great or compelling public interest and importance. You need to revisit these issues regularly because there are always new listeners. There are always people who might have missed it before. Maybe they didn't hear it in its entirety. Maybe they came in at the tail end of the last presentation. Or maybe they are bringing to this issue a new understanding as a result of intervening experiences or circumstances in their own lives or in the lives of people who matter to them. And therefore, you know, you never hear the same thing twice. You might have heard this before when we presented this material many months ago. Since then, someone you know might have fallen victim to this new Jim Crow, to this mass incarceration in the age of colorblindness. And you are now listening to this material with new insights, and it now resonates with a different meaning to you personally. I hope that that is not the case, but statistically speaking, it is very likely the case for some people who are listening to us right now. And that is the reality of life. And we are here to fulfill the responsibility and the mission of making sure that these issues, which are neglected in the mainstream corporate media, are nevertheless an placed out there into the public discourse and that they are given the level of attention that they deserve. Others may be turning a Nelson's eye to this, but our job, our responsibility is to put it out there, to insert it to into the public discourse by any and whatever means necessary. 212-209-2950 is our telephone number. The revised and updated edition of Michelle Alexander's New York Times best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. It's available as a thank you gift to you this afternoon with your pledge at the $60 level. We also have Professor Alexander's talk about The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, and that talk is available on DVD, and it's also at the $60 pledge level. But this afternoon, I am very pleased to be able to offer you both of these items, both of these thank you gifts, the book and the companion DVD, the book and the talk, with a pledge as a thank you gift for your pledge at the $100 level. It's 212-209-2950. So please continue to keep these calls coming while the presentation is in progress, as we return now to more of Professor Michelle Alexander talking her lecture at the Abyssinian Baptist Church this year, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness.
Knowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates in the United States have moved independently of one another. Incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have soared regardless of whether crime was going up or down in any given community or the nation as a whole. Now, people often tell me, well, shouldn't we focus on the front end, on keeping kids in schools and fixing our schools so they don't wind up in prison? And my answer is yes, yes. We absolutely must fix our schools and give each child a quality education so they have an opportunity to compete in this new global economy. And if we want to bring down violent crime rates, there's absolutely nothing more important than education and job creation. William Julius Wilson's book, When Work Disappears, he cites data showing that if you control for joblessness, in other words, if you compare white jobless men with black jobless men, the racial disparities in violent crime disappear. Now, joblessness is not an excuse for violence by any means. But if we want to reduce violent crime in our communities, the best remedy is education and job creation. But reducing crime rates, simply reducing crime rates, will not end mass incarceration. Let me repeat that. Simply reducing crime rates will not end mass incarceration. Why? Because crime rates have not been driving the explosion of our prison system. So what has, if not crime and crime rates? Well, it turns out that the activists who post that sign on the telephone pole were right. The war on drugs and the Get Tough movement, the wave of punitiveness that washed over the United States. What has changed dramatically is not so much crime, but what gets defined as crime and how we respond to it. And nothing has contributed more to this harsh response than the war on drugs. Drug convictions alone, just drug convictions, accounted for 2/3 of the increase in the federal prison system and more than half of the increase in the state prison system between 1985 and 2000, the period of our prison system's most dramatic expansion. Drug convictions have increased more than 1,000% since the drug war began. But to get a sense of how large a contribution the war on drugs has made to mass incarceration, consider this. There are more people in prisons and jails today just for drug offenses than were incarcerated for all reasons in 1980. Now, most Americans violate drug laws in their lifetime. Most do. It's what the research shows. But the drug war, not by accident, has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though studies have consistently shown now for decades that, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites, or sell. Now, that defies our basic racial stereotypes about who's a drug dealer. Now, if you picture a drug dealer in your mind, you're probably picturing some black kid standing street corner with his pants sagging. Plenty of drug dealing happens in the hood, but it happens everywhere else in America as well. A white kid living in rural Kansas doesn't drive to the hood to get his marijuana or his meth or his cocaine. No, he gets it most likely from someone of his own race down the road. In fact, where significant differences in the survey data appear, it frequently suggests that white youth are more likely to engage in illegal drug dealing than black youth. But that's not what you would guess by taking a peek inside our nation's prisons and jails, which are overflowing with black and brown drug offenders. In some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been one race, African American. Now, I find that many people, when they see the data, they're stunned and they say, yeah, that's awful. Those racial disparities, it's astounding. But still, we need to be waging a drug war in those ghetto communities, because that's where the violent offenders can be found. That's where the drug kingpins can be found. They say it makes sense to wage the drug war in the ghetto communities because we have to get tough with them. That's where the violence is. Indeed, in my experience, most people seem to imagine that the war on drugs was declared in response to the emergence of crack cocaine and the related violence. And for a while, I believed that too. But it's not true. It's not the case. President Ronald Reagan declared the current drug war in 1982 at a time when drug crime was on the decline, not on the rise. He declared the drug war before, not after, crack became a media sensation and was ravaging inner city communities. President Richard Nixon was the first to coin the term a war on drugs, but it was President Ronald Reagan who turned that rhetorical war into a literal one. And at the time he declared his drug war, drug crime was actually on the decline, and less than 3% of the American population identified drugs as the nation's most pressing concern. So why declare a drug war at a time when drug crime is declining and the American population isn't much concerned about drugs? Well, the answer is that from the outset, the drug war had relatively little to do with genuine concern about drug addiction or drug abuse, and nearly everything to do with politics, racial politics. Numerous historians and political scientists have now documented that the war on drugs was part of a grand Republican Party strategy known as the Southern Strategy, of using racially coded, get tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare to appeal to poor and working class whites in the South who were resentful of, fearful of, anxious about many of the gains of African Americans in the civil rights movement. Now, to be fair, I think we have to acknowledge that poor and working class whites really had their world rocked by the civil rights movement. You know, wealthy whites, they could send their kids to private schools, give their kids all of the advantages that wealth has to offer. But poor and working class whites were faced with a social demotion. It was their kids who might be bused across town to go to a school they believed was inferior. It was their kids and themselves who were suddenly forced to compete on equal terms for limited jobs with this whole new group of people they've been taught their whole lives to believe were inferior to them. And then to make matters worse from their perspective, affirmative action programs created the perception that black folks were now leapfrogging over them on their way to Harvard and Yale and fancy jobs in corporate America. And this state of affairs created an enormous amount of fear, resentment, anger, but it also created an enormous political opportunity. Pollsters and political strategists found that thinly veiled promises to get tough on them, a group of people not so suddenly defined by race, could be enormously successful in persuading poor and working class whites to defect from the Democratic New Deal coalition and join the Republican Party in droves. In fact, in the words of H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's former chief of staff, he explained the strategy this way, quote, "The whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to," end quote. Well, they did. A couple years after the drug war was announced, crack cocaine began to ravage inner city communities. And the Reagan administration seized on this development with glee, actually hiring staff whose job it was to feed to the media stories of inner city crack babies and crack deals and the so-called crack whores and crack-related violence. Their goal was to make crack a media sensation in the hopes that it would bolster public support for a drug war they had already declared and persuade Congress to devote millions more dollars to waging it. And the plan worked like a charm. Almost overnight, our television sets were saturated with images of crack babies, crack dealers, the so-called crack whores. And a wave of punitiveness swept over the United States, and soon Congress was passing harsh mandatory minimums for possession of small amounts of crack cocaine and other drugs, sentences harsher than murderers receive in some other Western democracies. And soon, Democrats began competing with Republicans to prove they could be even tougher on them than their Republican counterparts. And so it was President Bill Clinton who escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican predecessors even dreamed possible. And it was President Clinton that championed laws denying federal financial aid to drug offenders for college. It was President Clinton who championed laws banning people with criminal convictions from access to public housing so that people wouldn't have housing upon release from prison. It was the Clinton administration that championed laws denying even food stamps under federal law to people who were once caught with drugs. To a large extent, the basic architecture of this new caste system was championed by a Democratic administration desperate to win back the so-called white swing voters, the folks who had defected from the Democratic Party in the wake of the civil rights movement. Still, in my experience, many people who are familiar with this history defend the drug war and mass incarceration nonetheless. They say, but what about all those drug kingpins and what about the violence in our communities? Don't we need this war to deal with them? And it is true. We need an aggressive approach to dealing with the violence that plagues our communities. But let's be clear, this drug war has never been aimed at rooting out the drug kingpins or the most violent offenders. Never has. Never has. federal funding in this war has flowed to those state and local law enforcement agencies that boost the sheer volume of drug arrests. It's been a numbers game. State and local law enforcement agencies are rewarded in cash by the millions for the sheer numbers of people swept in to the system for drug offenses. This helps to explain why law enforcement so often goes out looking for the so-called low-hanging fruit, stopping, frisking, searching as many people as possible, pulling as many vehicles as possible over in a search for drugs. But of course, they don't do that so much in middle-class white neighborhoods. They don't sweep college campuses and universities for drugs, though plenty can be found there, I can assure you. No. These tactics are applied only in poor communities of color, because that's where they can get away with it and still get paid. And the results are predictable. People of color have been rounded up in mass for relatively minor, nonviolent drug offenses. In 2005, for example, 4 out of 5 drug arrests were for simple possession, only 1 out of 5 for sales. Most people in state prison for drug offenses have no history of violence or significant selling activity. And in fact, in the 1990s, the Clinton years, period of the greatest escalation of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession. A drug has now been shown to be less harmful, less addictive than alcohol or tobacco, and at least, if not more prevalent, in middle-class white communities and on college campuses as it is in the hood. But by waging the drug war exclusively in the hood, we've managed to create a vast new racial undercast in an astonishingly short period of time. Millions of people are now saddled with criminal records and legally denied the very rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. Now, where has the U.S. Supreme Court been in all of this? Well, the truth is, the U.S. Supreme Court has facilitated the rise of mass incarceration. After the drug war was declared, the Supreme Court eviscerated Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. You know, once upon a time, it wasn't legal for the police to just roll up on anybody on the street, stop, interrogate them, frisk them. No, that was considered an unreasonable search and seizure, the very kind of police activity the framers meant to prohibit. But after the drug war was declared, in a series of decisions, the U.S. Supreme Court eviscerated those protections and ruled that as long as the police have consent, they can stop, frisk, search just about anybody, anywhere. Now, what's consent? Consent is when a police officer walks up to a young kid on the street and the officer's got hand on his gun and says, "Son, put your hands up in the air so I can frisk you and see if you got anything on you." Kid goes, "Uh-huh." That's consent.
Now here's that dialing music for you. Let's listen to some of this music while you dial 212-209-2950 and get a copy of this compelling talk by Professor Michelle Alexander discussing her book, her New York Times best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. The talk is available as a standalone item with your pledge at the $60 level. The book is also available as a thank you gift at the as a standalone item at the $60 level. Or you can get both the book and the DVD of the talk with your pledge at the $100 level, which is, of course, the better deal. So your $100 pledge. Remember, you can pay the you can do this in installments. You can do this, use your American Express, Visa, MasterCard. You can send a check, 212-209-2950. We're looking now to fill the board. We can take 15 of your calls at any given time. I'm looking for a total of 30 calls in this break over the next 4 minutes or so, 4 or 5 minutes. So 212-209-2950. We need to hear from you now. Here's some dialing music to get you going. 212-209-2950. And we thank you very much for your support. Two zero nine two nine five zero. 28 minutes after the hour. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live on the web at WBAI.org. Our fall membership and fundraising drive continues. I am Hugh Hamilton with Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer and director of incidental music. This afternoon we are featuring the work of Professor Michelle Alexander. And we're offering you, as a thank you gift this afternoon, at the $60 pledge level, we're sending you a copy of her talk at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. It was a rousing, compelling, highly informative and inspirational, wonderfully and beautifully motivational talk delivered by Professor Michelle Alexander, discussing her New York Times best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. We also have the revised and updated edition of the book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. That book is also available with your pledge at the $60 level. Or you can get both the book and the lecture. The lecture is available on DVD. You can get both the book and the talk with your pledge at the $100 level. We're looking now for your calls to fill the board. We're looking now for an additional 11 of your calls right now. 212-209-2950. The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Do you know, I want to read you a bit from this book while you get to the phones and call 212-209-2950. I want to read for you from a section in which Michelle Alexander writes about how this system, how this new Jim Crow works, and how it disproportionately targets particularly young men of color. Michelle Alexander, she writes, precisely how the system of mass incarceration works to trap African Americans in a virtual and literal cage can best be understood by viewing the system as a whole. Only when we view the cage from a distance can we disengage from the maze of rationalizations that are offered for each wire and see how the entire apparatus operates to keep African Americans perpetually trapped. This, in brief, is how the system works. The war on drugs is the vehicle through which extraordinary numbers of black men are forced into the cage. The entrapment occurs in three distinct phases, each of which which has been explored earlier, but a brief review is useful here. The first stage is the roundup. Vast numbers of people are swept into the criminal justice system by the police, who conduct drug operations primarily in poor communities of color. They are rewarded in cash through drug forfeiture laws and federal grant programs for rounding up as many people as possible. And they operate unconstrained by constitutional rules of procedure that once were considered inviolate. Police can stop, interrogate, and search anyone they choose for drug investigations, provided they get so-called consent. Because there is no meaningful check on the exercise of police discretion, racial biases are granted free rein. In fact, police are allowed to rely on race as a factor in selecting whom to stop and search, even though people of color are no more likely to be guilty of drug crimes than whites, effectively guaranteeing that those who are swept into the system are primarily black and brown. The conviction marks the beginning of the second phase, the period of formal control. Once arrested, defendants are generally denied meaningful legal representation and pressured to plead guilty, whether they are or not. Prosecutors are free to load up defendants with extra charges, and their decisions cannot be challenged for racial bias. Once convicted, due to the drug war's harsh sentencing laws, drug offenders in the United States spend more time under the criminal justice system's formal control, in jail or prison, on probation or parole, than drug offenders anywhere else in the world. While under formal control, virtually every aspect of one's life is regulated and monitored by the system, and any form of resistance or disobedience is subject to swift sanction. This period of control may last a lifetime, even for those convicted of extremely minor non-violent offenses, but the vast majority of those swept up into the system are eventually released. They are transferred from their prison cells to a much larger invisible cage. And here now, she writes about the final stage. Now, I want you to pay particular attention to this this period that Professor Alexander calls the final stage, because this is the aspect of this problem of mass incarceration that very often most of us do not recognize or acknowledge. And please continue to call 212-209-2950 while I'm sharing this information with you. This is a phase of the operation. You know, it's we talk about people who are in prison or in jail, or people who are on parole, or people who are on probation. We talk about the fact that there are 6 million people in this country who are in under some form of correctional supervision. But what happens to those people once they are released, once they are no longer in jail or prison, once they are no longer on probation or on parole? I think that this is where Professor Michelle Alexander really makes one of her most compelling arguments, an argument that is most often overlooked. And this argument alone is worth the price of admission. So please continue to call 212-209-2950. Remember, you get the book, the revised and updated edition of the New Jim Crow, the New York Times bestseller, as a standalone item with your pledge at the $60 level. You can also get her talk at the Abyssinian Baptist Church on DVD. That's also available as a $60 pledge level. Or you can get both the book and the DVD with your pleasure at the $100 level. Now, the number to call, 212-209-2950. Professor Alexander then goes on to write in her book about the final stage, which has been dubbed by some advocates the period of invisible punishment. Think about that for a moment. the period of invisible punishment. This term, first coined by Jeremy Travis, is meant to describe the unique set of criminal sanctions that are imposed on individuals after they step outside the prison gates, a form of punishment that operates largely outside of public view and takes effect outside the traditional sentencing framework. These sanctions are imposed by operation of law rather than decisions of a sentencing judge, yet they often have a greater impact on one's life course than the months or years one actually spends behind bars. Think about that for a moment. These laws operate collectively to ensure that the vast majority of convicted offenders will never integrate into mainstream white society. They will be discriminated against legally for the rest of their lives, denied unemployment, housing, education, and public benefits. Unable to surmount these obstacles, most will eventually return to prison and then be released again, caught in a closed circuit of perpetual marginality. In recent years, she writes, advocates and politicians have called for greater resources devoted to the problem of prisoner reentry in view of the unprecedented numbers of people who are released from prison and return to their communities every year. While the terminology is well-intentioned, it utterly fails to convey the gravity of the situation facing prisoners upon their release. People who have been convicted of felonies almost never truly re-enter the society they inhabited prior to their conviction. I want to read that sentence again for you. People who have been convicted of felonies almost never truly re-enter the society they inhabited prior to their conviction. Instead, they enter a separate society, a world hidden from public view, governed by a set of oppressive and discriminatory rules and laws that do not apply to everyone else. They become members of an undercaste, an enormous population of predominantly black and brown people who, because of the drug war, are denied basic rights and privileges of American citizenship and are permanently relegated to an inferior status. This is the final phase, and there is no going back. This from Professor Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. I'm reading here from the revised and updated edition of the book. Ladies and gentlemen, I do not believe that I need go any further in order to ask, to encourage, to exhort you to go to the phones and to make that call, to make that pledge of support. Because you and I both know there is no other radio station that is going to share this information, that is going to present this lecture by Michelle Alexander on the new Jim Crow, or that is going to share and offer this book. This book is a game changer. This book has changed both the tone and the content and the quality of the public conversation on issues of mass incarceration in this country. This book has revolutionized our collective understanding. As you know, once in a while, a book comes along that changes the way we see the world and helps to fuel a nationwide social movement. And this book, The New Jim Crow, is such a book. This revised and updated edition with a new foreword by Professor Cornel West is available as a thank you gift to you with your pledge at the $60 level. Or you can get Michelle Alexander's talk on the new Jim Crow at the Abyssinian Baptist Church at the $60 pledge level. Or you can get them both the book and the DVD with her talk as a thank you gift with your $100 tax deductible contribution to WBAI. Now, I should not have to belabor this point. If you already have this, then you can get another copy for someone else, perhaps. And if you have not yet made a pledge of support, this is the time to do it. This is the moment to do so. And as I mentioned earlier, in case you missed it, after today, I'm not going to be back here again for another week because I'm taking some time off. This is part of my annual vacation. So I'm taking about a week or so off. So you and I are not going to be doing this again until either next Thursday of next week or the following Monday. Either Thursday 25th or Monday 29th. Either of those days. So, you're going to be, there are going to be others who will, of course, be presenting fantastic programs in my absence in this time slot. But I'd like to be able to walk out of here this afternoon knowing that we have done well and that this afternoon's edition of the program, this fundraising edition of Talkback, has been highly successful. And that can happen only with the benefit of your support. So I'm asking you to go to the phones right now and to make that call at whatever level is convenient and comfortable for you. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. I'm going to rely on the honor system here and hope that you will call while the presentation is in progress. You always come through for us, and so I know you will again, but you don't have to make it a nail biter. 212-209-2950. Thank you very much to those who are on the line right now. Please continue to call while the presentation is in progress as we return to more of Professor Michelle Alexander discussing the new Jim Crow, mass incarceration in the age of color blindness.
Protections against unreasonable searches and seizures no longer applies to that encounter. Now, the Supreme Court knows that very few people dare to refuse consent when a police officer says, "May I search you? May I speak with you for a moment?" But even when someone does refuse consent, it'll be their word against a police officer's in a court of law. And who is the judge more likely to believe? In this way, the U.S. Supreme Court has granted the police license to sweep communities, stopping, frisking, tossing people, extraordinarily high numbers of folks. Here in New York City, there were 614,000 stops and frisks in 2010.